This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Over these weeks, we've been alternating programs with instrumentalists and conductors and American composers, and today we'll visit with a composer who lives in multiple music worlds and has been very successful in this duality, the composer, saxophonist, arranger, and record producer, Patrick Zimmerle. He grew up surrounded by music in his home, his brother, an accomplished classical pianist. My guest migrated in the other direction, namely jazz, and his first success came right out of high school, winning Jazz Downbeat Awards and moving on to Jazz Composer Competition prizes, performing with top jazz musicians, at the same time being fascinated with the European-American hardcore classical avant-garde of Babbitt, Boulez, and Stockhausen. This was rare for a composer his age, and rarer for a composer firmly rooted in a jazz idiom. He spent many years in recordings attempting to mix both worlds, and then, as you'll hear him tell, he transformed his style to something stemming from, say, Bach and Brahms to Bartok, while still composing for and performing and collaborating with top musicians and in prestigious venues. You're listening to two top piano talents, Brad Meldow and Kevin Hayes, performing my guest's piece titled, appropriately, Modern Music, from a Nonesuch CD by the same name. Patrick Zimmerle splits his time between New York and Paris, but is still extremely active composing and performing, honing and displaying his unique set of talents. I spoke with him by phone a few weeks back. happy to be speaking today with composer, saxophonist, saxophonist, composer. I'm not really sure what order you want those in, Patrick Zimmerle. You're the type of composer and musician I don't have the opportunity to talk with often on this program. So I'm going to have a big overarching question to begin with here, because we're in 2018, and I'm just wondering, because you can move back and forth, if you could articulate the differences, but also the difficulties and rewards of having your music, your compositions performed by a quote-unquote new classical audience or venue and a new jazz audience and venue. I mean, is there still a difference in 2018? And what are those differences?
Okay, well, you ask about audience and venue, and you don't ask about ensemble.
Well, we'll get...
Is that intentional?
Yeah.
Are you asking a question about venues, or are you questioning about audiences, or a question about ensemble?
Right now, I'm curious as to how your music is received. So we'll get to the musicians in a second, all that, but...
I think that there is a big difference between the concert-going populations of classical music and jazz. I'm not sure if it's as different at the nexus of new jazz and new classical music. So, I mean, when we play in classical venues, you still find a younger crowd to hear. I mean, the classical music is notoriously played mostly to older people. By the way, my music has been very successful amongst the old, and I'm a big fan of old people in general. I'm not amongst those who considers younger to be better.
Right.
So quite the contrary. So I have a good relationship both personally and artistically with older audiences. With that said, though, a lot of younger people will come if we play at traditionally classical music, classical venues. And I guess the same would go for when we play in more, my music plays in more jazz-oriented places. Actually, though, I haven't really presented my music in really traditional jazz venues, such as the Village Vanguard or real places really like that. So it hasn't really been tested in those places. And I have some schemes to try to change that and see what happens. But for now, my music has not really been played in, like, jazz clubs too much. I think jazz places view me as much more of a sort of music that needs to be listened to attentively and therefore would not go over well with a jazz crowd. I'm not sure that that's the case, but certainly that's what presenters seem to think at the moment.
And it's the same on the classical side, is that, you know, either series or venues that present pretty conservative classical programming, your European composer base, that's not where new classical music generally is being is a hotbed for new classical music. I'm just curious, between the two audiences, is there a real distinction now between those that are seeking out new music on the quote-unquote jazz side, and I'm putting those in quotes, and those that are attending new classical, you know, new music concerts? I'm just curious.
That's a really sticky and nuanced question, actually. But I think that the short answer would have to be that no, there is a lot of overlap between new music audiences in both places. But if you're really talking about the new music audience in New York City as opposed to the jazz audience, I think there's a little bit less of intersection. I mean, new music has its own crowd that sort of goes to every new music event.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's a little bit balkanized. And I guess new jazz, maybe a little bit less so. It's more, a little bit more open.
Well, go to the other side then. My second question was about musicians that you perform with, that you have relationships with, that have the sensibilities you do. I mean, some of the musicians you've played with over the years, your roots go way back with them. But I'm just curious, these days, where do you have the musicians that flow like you do on, you know, that type of thing?
Well, I would have to say that my path has been so particular that I'm always offering a new dimension to the musicians I work with, no matter what side of things they come from. I mean, certainly there are people like John Hollenbeck out there that can just do anything I ask him to do with really no problem. And in fact, I could write really, really challenging music for John and he would have no problem with it. But for most of the people that I work with, I wind up stretching them or expanding them in one way or in another because I have experience in traditional jazz, which classical musicians lack.
Right.
I have experience in traditional classical music, which jazz musicians don't really have that much of a perspective on. And I have this sort of rhythmic dimension to what I do, which neither jazz nor classical musicians have a lot of experience with generally. So I sort of combine that into a brew that makes for a sort of challenging and broadening experience for almost everyone that I work with.
Okay. From my guest Patrick Zimmerle's CD and work titled Book of Hours, movements spanning from dawn to sleep, here's an interlude sextet between the movements Dusk and Night, performed by my guest and the musicians of Octurne. Just to back up on you a bit, you grew up northern New York in Westchester County.
Yes.
A lot of music in your family. Your brother was a pretty accomplished classical pianist.
Yes.
How did you migrate? How did jazz come into what you were doing? Growing up in a household where your brother was playing Beethoven and Bach and Brahms.
Yes. Well, I mean, it was pretty cut and dried because I was not allowed near the piano, actually. That was my brother's turf. He was sort of a prodigy. And so I was discouraged from playing the piano at a young age, and actually you can still hear that when you listen to me play piano. You can hear someone who is discouraged from playing it. But the thing is that, you know, how siblings tend to differentiate themselves, and I quickly found that I had a talent for improvisation that my brother, who is in all other respects, brilliant. Well, I mean, actually, he could improvise, but not in the same way. I mean, he was much more someone who's interpreting other people's music, and I had a sort of talent for making things up as I went along, and that was spotted by a couple of music teachers along the way, and I was given some encouragement. I was playing woodwinds because those were reasonably safe from the keyboard in terms of what they did. And so when I was in seventh grade to West Hartford, Connecticut, there was a public school there with a very good jazz band called Hall High School. That's where Brad Meldow, Joel Fromm, and scads of younger people who I don't know as well went to high school also. So they had a very competitive jazz program, and the jazz band would go to Europe, tour Europe, and so forth. So I was very motivated to get my jazz playing together, and it's there that I really got to really deep into jazz, studying it and learning from some of the local musicians there, and wound up playing quite a bit professionally when I was in high school.
Just going to tick off some things here before we move into the classical side, but the jazz side. I mean, you won some award, Downbeat Awards. You won.
That's right. Yeah.
Thelonious Monk.
Yeah, that was a big thing. I remember. I guess you can, when you get old, you can talk. You can sort of brag about your younger self. But I was quite good when I was like really young. I could sound credibly like Ben Webster. I remember playing "But Beautiful" on one of the tapes I sent into Downbeat and doing a little Ben Webster shtick. And that seemed to go over. And then I was really into trains, so I did this version of Cherokee, but with sort of giant steps changes on the bridge. It was quite sort of like fancy. And anyway, so the judges seemed to like that a lot. So I won those Downbeat Awards and was doing sort of well as a jazz musician by high school standards. So that was, you know, but I mean, at that time, I was really listening a lot to Joe Henderson and Sonny and all those guys and really trying to absorb that tradition in as profound a way as I could.
And as you then furthered your education, I mean, you actually went to Columbia to be a composer. You won the Thelonious Monk Composers Competition. But on the jazz world, you were kind of entering this with composition as kind of a focal point. But you were coming into a jazz world that still had, at that time, a lot of the old guard around, lot of the old jazz musicians. And you were not, you were an outsider to them, I would think, you know.
Very much so, yeah. I mean, well, I should say that when I went to school, when I was 18, I actually didn't really want to go to college. I just wanted to be a jazz musician. I just wanted to be a jazz musician at that time. And my parents were like, well, that's good, but, you know, you've got the grades. Just go ahead and go to college, you know. And so I went to Columbia because it was in New York, and I figured the best musicians would be there. But it was at Columbia that I got interested in composition. That's sort of like the sequence of events.
Okay.
Now, the jazz scene, yeah, I had friends that were my age and that were brilliant jazz musicians. I mean, frankly, they were a step ahead of me. People like Kevin Hayes, Scott Colley, Bill Stewart. I was playing with those guys when I was just out of high school or even in high school. And, you know, those guys went on to have amazing careers playing with some of the great jazz musicians that were still alive at that time. But their disposition was a little bit more straight ahead than mine. And so, yeah, I was a little bit less accepted by the older guard of jazz musicians. And at the same time, I just developed this interest in contemporary classical composition, and I got more and more into that. But my first objective was to incorporate the things that I was learning in the contemporary classical context into my jazz writing.
Because we're going to jump to that, and I'm putting this in quotes, but whatever history looks back at as the 20th century, it's going to have this kind of dark side, you know, and it's and you were enthralled by this 20th century strain of what were called then avant-garde composers when they were in their heyday. But we're talking
right.
about Milton Babbitt, Elliot Carter,
yeah.
Pierre Boulez, Karlheinz Stockhausen. And they fascinated you, inspired you. You worked a lot of what they were doing, tried to do into your compositions. What about this? I mean, this is not, I'm not going to say normal, but this is not usual for a jazz composer to be this into this brand, this strain of classical music.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I know, and it is a little strange. I remember that I was kind of passionate about, I wanted to explore and push boundaries. That was sort of like something that was really interesting to me when I was that age. And so for me, I was discovering people like Bartok and then Schoenberg and all those people. And then I found out that there were these new composers and they were doing really crazy, really dissonant things. And I was amazed by this. So I think that's kind of why I got into Elliot Carter. And then I'd always heard about this guy, Milton Babbitt, but he was like, his music was like the furthest out there that you could imagine. And then I remember going to hear some concerts of his music and finding it surprisingly limpid and sensible. It like made sense to me. It wasn't just dissonance for dissonance's sake. There was a kind of underlying, there was something there. It caught my ear. There was something that pulled me along. And then I just got really, for some strange reason, I agree that it's strange. And I developed a passion for the music of Milton Babbitt. This passion I found not to be generally transferable.
If Milton was still here, he'd agree with you, I think, if he was still with us.
And indeed, some ex-girlfriends spent some frustrating hours trying to...
You got to hear this.
exactly. It didn't quite work out the way I expected. But, you know, this music, it really captured my imagination. And also the Europeans, like you say, to some extent, Boulez and Stockhausen, I got into for a while. And this music really captured my imagination. But in particular, I saw in the music resources that could be brought into jazz. And to me, it made perfect sense because the whole thing of jazz was, jazz seemed to me to lag behind European classical music around 30 years or so, you know, so, or maybe less. But like, you know, Duke Ellington, to me, Duke is really indebted to Debussy.
Yeah.
He like brought some of Debussy's compositional tricks into the world of jazz, and no one noticed because it was jazz, you know? He put a beat to it. But, I mean, also, you could think of the Coltrane Quartet as really coming a lot out of Hindemith. Even Byrd was checking out some of that music and getting inspiration. So there was this real sense of inspiration of jazz coming from 20th century classical music, but with a little bit of a lag time. So it made perfect sense to me that the music of Babin and Carter and those guys would seep its way into jazz a little bit later, just as had happened traditionally. So I was like, yeah, man, I am squarely in the jazz tradition. Really, I was a jazz musician at the time, and even though I was checking out all this music, my intention was to appropriate it for a jazz context in a way that made complete and total sense. Unfortunately, it didn't make complete and total sense to the rest of the world.
Square that circle, if you will, because those that know the music of the composers we were talking about and those that appreciate what jazz is and some of the aesthetics behind jazz, the music of Babbitt and Carter, to a certain extent, especially with the rhythm and stuff, is highly controlled, highly, highly structured. Nothing is out of place. And jazz has the, right or wrong, has the distinction of freedom to it in some way, of spontaneity. Equal those up for us. How does it play out in your compositions? I mean, in your mind?
I mean, my take on like total serialism, if you want to get technical, is this. Schoenberg, he started to launch free of tonality in the beginning of the 20th century, and he was trying all these different things, but what stuck him was he wanted to create this sense of total freedom, but he didn't know how to write sort of extended pieces. He was like, wait, you know, you can write crazy stuff, but how does it begin, continue, and end? There's no real sense to it. There's no underlying structure. So then he came up with this 12-tone method. It was a way of creating structure and creating kind of prolongation in the same way that classical music of the past had. But it was a kind of an ad hoc way of just giving continuation and being able to create larger structures and forms while still giving that sense of complete freedom. So when you get to total serialism, it's that even more. Like with Babbitt's music is like an extended, written-out improvisation to me, very much so, but an improvisation that has a means of continuation because of its structure. So he can keep going, and there's a kind of internal logic to it. Whether that logic is apprehensible to the listener or not is perhaps secondary. I think what he wanted to do is like create structured freedom, actually. Now, on the other hand, we have jazz with its supposed freedom to it, but in fact, jazz has traditionally been highly structured. And a lot of the music that I think that jazz, actually, free jazz, came up against the same problem that Schoenberg came up with. Well, okay, you can just play all this expressive stuff, but then where does it go? It doesn't really go anywhere. And a lot of listeners experienced that frustration. Maybe it was kind of liberating for the musicians, but sometimes the music got caught in patterns. If you talk to an improvising jazz musician, they'll tell you it's very difficult not to fall back on things you already know. There's a real tension between improvisation. In fact, I was just discussing this with Ben Maunder the other day. You know, improvisation, there's a tension between improvisation and perfection. If you play something that you already know, then you're going to have a better chance of playing it well because you've already played it before. On the other hand, if you play something you don't know, it's going to be more difficult and challenging technically. So there's a big tension and a big play and a big concern. I think both in written music and in improvised music, about how to deal with these things and create something that's effective and satisfying, but at the same time gives you a feeling of freedom. And so I think that those are the concerns that both free jazz and contemporary classical music are addressing.
It's interesting. It's just a short story, but when I was doing my graduate degrees, which is now nearly 40 years ago, sadly.
Where'd you go?
Northwestern University. Keith Jarrett came to do a master class. And at that time, he would say that his long improvisations at the piano were actually compositions. And the jazz people were supposed to come, but they had a rehearsal. So a lot of us composition majors came and sat in. And of course, we were trying to trap him. And so one of the questions was, what happens when you're spitting out this quote-unquote improvisation/composition, and you get stuck for an idea? And he said, well, I just vamp on something I know, which is exactly what you just said, that you fall back, then it's not compositional freedom. In your own pieces, thinking of, before we move to your change here, but in thinking about the music of controlled music of Babbitt and Boulez, how did you play that out? Were your pieces more notated for the musicians you were playing with? I mean, how did that work itself out?
Well, for me, what I wound up doing was I tried to combine the two. I would write very structured pieces. I mean, we can talk about Shores Against Silence just because it's something that's out there more recently, and I'm actually going to go and look at it and get inspired by talking some of the pieces. I would use some of those techniques, but write sort of very simple jazz tunes. No one knew how simple they were, just using some of the rhythmic and harmonic and really contrapuntal techniques that I learned from Carter and Babbitt, and I would put those into a kind of solo's head format and have people improvise in that context. And that was very difficult for the musicians because we all know what to do over A flat minor 7, but if you put A flat minor over 7 in the context of sort of two lines that are very spread apart registrally and that are changing very quickly but that are equaling at moments A flat minor 7, it's harder to respond to that improvisationally.
I even read, and we don't want to get too musical geeky here for our audience, but jazz musicians traditionally have chords, and the chords move along, and that's what they improvise on. You were actually at one time trying to do intervals between, right?
Yeah, well, I guess you're a composer person, so I can talk to you about Alan Fort and pitch class.
That gets really geeky.
Yeah, indeed. Sorry about that. So we would take, how Alan Fort splits things into 12 trichords, for example, 12 possible three-note chords. So we would use those three-note chords as sort of chords that would change. That was one thing that I tried highly unsuccessfully to get my colleagues like Kevin Hayes and Scott Colley to understand and deal with. Instead of having something that's centered around a tonic, you have something that's centered around a set of intervallic relations. It didn't work. It was a good idea. It just didn't work.
Track from the CD Explosion, this called Don't Stop, music by my guest Patrick Zimmerle, and he performs on tenor sax with guitarist Ben Monder and Tomu Takeshi on fretless electric bass and Satoshi Takeshi on percussion. Thank you. it wasn't only ex-girlfriends, but I think you also found out that your music wasn't, the message wasn't getting across. So I guess it's with the recording of two piano trios, multi-movement piano trios.
Oh, yeah.
Would you say you kind of moved from Boulez and Babbitt to Bach and Brahms with Bartok in between? But talk about the switch.
Absolutely, yeah. So I was obviously, and still can get myself to be, very animated and excited by these ideas. In fact, I found as I played out with groups that we would rehearse, first of all, it took a really long time for us to rehearse some of this music. So we would rehearse for weeks and months and then go present some stuff. You know, jazz musicians were just not, I include myself, we were not used to this vocabulary. It's not like today where you can bring a piece of music, very complicated music, to a new music ensemble and they can really have the tools to deal with them. We did not have those. So that's why we had to rehearse a lot. Then we would present the music. Sometimes it would be a mess. And musicians in the audience would come up and be like, wow, that was great. It was clear that they had no idea what was actually going on, you know. So I realized that I was going over the heads of a lot of people, certainly a lot of people, and even musicians. And then I guess it all culminated. We got a month of Fridays and Saturdays playing at the Guggenheim Museum in the Rotunda to accompany an exhibition called Abstraction in the 20th Century. And this was my ensemble, which was Ben Maunder, Satoshi Takeishi, and Stomu Takeishi. This was the group with which I went the furthest along these directions, and we recorded two CDs for Songlines. And so we had this gig, and it was great because, you know, it was going to be Jackson Pollock on the wall and Rothko and Gerhard Richter and all these guys that had been big influences on me also from the visual arts, and my music was finally going to make sense and be understood. But that didn't happen, of course. People were having a hard time with music, right. Let's just say, and the promoters of the event in the middle of the week were, you know, could you guys play more standards? Could you play more stuff like that? And I was like, standards? How does that go with Abstraction of the 20th Century? Anyway, the whole experience made me really realize that there was a real difference between the visual arts and the musical arts in that, you know, music is something you can't really escape from. I mean, if it's playing Rotunda, then there's nowhere to go. Whereas if you don't like a Jackson Pollock, you can just go to the next room.
Right.
You know what I mean? And for a lot of other reasons, I was just flying over the heads of people, and the message of my music wasn't getting across. I felt like I had a message that it's an abstract thing, but you feel like you want to impart something to people who are sort of intellectually curious and sort of open-minded, and I just didn't feel like it was reading, you know? So that was really frustrating to me, and instead of, like, pointing to everyone else and saying that they were too stupid, I decided that I should actually perhaps, that was not a very productive way to live your life, and that instead I should use different tools to communicate my message. And that's when I started writing more for classical ensembles. And yeah, I actually wrote a piano concerto, which was the start of it, for Kevin Hayes, but Ethan Iverson winded up premiering that with a group called Metamorphosen, which was a string orchestra in Boston, a fabulous string orchestra in Boston. And I don't know if you remember them.
Yeah.
And then I wrote another concerto for them. That was a very successful piece in a much easier style. And I wrote some more pieces for them and then some chamber music. And at that point, I had really gotten complexity out of my system. I'd done it, you know. I was okay. I was at peace with it. And then I could write as simple as I wanted to and still, like, sort of convey the things I wanted to convey.
You know, like I said, the piano trios disc, I mean, these are two piano trios, number one, number two, standard.
Yeah.
And you look at the movements named after the tempo markings. I mean, these could be from any of the past two centuries, you know, and as just on the paper. I mean, just, you know, as far as...
Well, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that I was always interested in very simple structure, and all of my music has had very, very simple forms. It's just that no one, when I was writing the jazz, it was really hard for people to discern that actually these pieces were like just ABA structures, head, solos, head. I mean, I would do a little bit, some departures for them in just the way that, like, sort of the big band writers like Duke would. But effectively, they were extremely simple in their structure. And so when I started writing for more classical ensembles, I just continued that. I was very interested in sonata form, and I wrote sonata form.
Yeah.
And I was like, is this a problem? It proves to be a problem for some people. But it seemed like, to me, like an extension of what I was already doing.
It's just sort of the opposite, where so many composers in the middle 20th century, they fled from sonata form, and you came back around to it through them. It's a very, very interesting path. So my guest switches compositional gears and turns out two classical piano trios. Here's the third movement, Energico, from the number one, performed by Scott Yu Violin, Michael Mermagen cello, and John Novacek piano, music by my guest today, Patrick Zimmerle. Speaking of structure and traditional forms, the latest CD, Clockworks,
Yes.
11 tracks, but it's a theme in variations. And
yes.
So you could talk about the piece itself and the movements, which some of them have very kind of structural tagging to them. Yet, I'm just curious about the theme and variations because, again, I'm just going to lay it out sort of naively, but for jazz, jazz kind of is structured traditionally how you would play jazz is a theme and variations where you play a theme and then you freely improvise and present variations on it. I'm just curious. It's, again, it's fascinating how you structured this as an entire 11 movement theme and variations, yet inside
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, I mean, I have some issues with people talking about jazz as theme and variations.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's what I said. It's,
because,
you know.
Because if you really check out real theme and variations, jazz is more like it's a chaconne. Jazz is basically a chaconne. Every jazz piece is that. You use the changes and you kind of develop and you play different things. But in terms of like variate, I mean, you know, if you think of like Diabelli or you think of like the Haydn variations, Brahms, it's very different. Those pieces, like the variations are structured. Each one has its own sort of musical character, and that's
right.
Not necessarily the case in jazz. In jazz, you know, people play chorus after chorus. The harmonic framework goes round and round.
Yeah, the grounding is there each time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
So.
It's slightly different. Anyway, the theme and variations quality of this piece, so Clockworks is a response to all the stuff we've been talking about
okay.
just now, in fact, because when I changed my style, my popularity as a composer, it spiked. It went up quite high. There were just a few people, a handful of people, maybe two or three or five at the most, who just were like completely scandalized and thought that I had sold out, you know. Those are the people that really liked my earlier style and just were just shaking their heads at how I could possibly have done this. And amongst them was indeed the pianist Ethan Iverson. Ethan had come to the recording session of Shores Against Silence. It was the second day he was in New York. He fell into this session and, you know, he was just completely blown away. And we had developed a very long relationship of working on stuff together. And we recorded a CD called 12 Sacred Dances together. So when he heard the piano trios, he was just like, you know, had his head buried in his hands, like, oh, God, what a loss to music. And so Ethan always kind of, like, kept that as an idea. And so I got this grant to write for my old ensemble, which had Ethan in it. And Ethan wanted a piece that sort of harkened back to my earlier style, you see. So I was somewhat, I guess I had mixed feelings about this exercise because I can assure you that while I wanted my musical message to reach more people, this was not something I did for any financial reasons. It was like the motivations were entirely artistic. And to go back and write in my old style, I was like, well, I don't know. But as it turned out, it was actually a lot easier. It's very comfortable for me to write rather complex music. It's not hard. And so the piece, though, in general, it goes on a trajectory from the complex to the simple.
Yeah.
And in a way, it mirrors my style. And in a way, it's subtly intended to tell Ethan, to explain my point to Ethan in musical terms. Because the theme, which is the last variation, it's a reverse theme in variations.
Right.
And the theme is a very simple one. And you hear it in the end coming out with its full harmonic form, more simple. But the first iteration of it is extremely abstract and sort of 20th century sounding. So I guess the idea is that you can put musical ideas in either simple or complex clothing, and it's the same ideas. The message can be similar. And in a way, the 11 variations are a kind of metaphor of my creative process because it all goes from the complex to the simple.
The way you just explained it, when you listen to the recording, what you said makes a lot of sense because that's what you hear. You hear this moving back and forth, you know.
Right.
It does come out very successfully. My guest Patrick Zimmerle's latest recording is this set of variations called Clockworks. He performs with his quintet, and we'll hear the final movement, which, since this is a backwards theme in variations, is the theme, and it is titled A Scattering of Stars. Thank you. We started the whole conversation by saying, here we are in 2018, you know, da, 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 da. So, I mean, where are we moving? I mean, a lot of the young composers, and I'm saying under 40 that I have on this program, they bring to their music, whatever they're creating, this whole trunk full of influences, be it popular music, be it jazz, be it music from different cultures or something like that. That's exciting, but I'm just curious, because you move in and out of these stylistic ways of composing, where are you going, and I guess where do you think things are heading? I know it's a dangerous question because no one has a crystal ball, but I'm just curious.
Well, I mean, I don't know what things you're talking about, and I guess that would be the answer to my question, because it's like there's no one thing anymore, right? I mean, there are a lot of people doing a lot of different things, some of them extremely successfully. I mean, the thorny, complex music strain, it lives on. And some of the people who are writing in that mold are writing, like, amazing music. Why? Because, of course, they have no motivation other than purely sort of being interested in that as musical expression. I'm thinking of, like, Jason Eckhart. I don't know if you know his music, but he writes this crazy, super complex. But it's great. I don't know. There's just something about it that's very forceful. It's very direct. It's very vivid. It's great stuff. And then you have people that are writing in a post-minimalist vein. I mean, you have Max Richter. I guess he might be somebody who would be on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. Max Richter might have more audience, but Jay's doing great and he's going strong. I see that continuing. You know, I think to me, it's like things just accumulate. There may be vogues in one direction or the other, but I don't think any of these musics is going to die off, actually. I think they're all going to continue for people for whom they resonate, and the internet certainly makes that possible, I should say. You can be into whatever obscure thing you like. I think that all things are going to continue, and there are going to be new things that are born. I mean, I can't say more than that. As far as what I'm doing, I'm continuing to write for musicians. I mean, to me, I guess it's coming more and more down to sort of the relationships that I've established with people and how they push me. I mean, I feel like Clockworks has Ethan's stamp on it aesthetically very much, because it's kind of like there's something of the traditional jazz. There's a kind of soulful traditional jazz quality that Ethan kind of brings to it, and of course John and Chris as well. And then this CD with Josh Redman that I have coming out with Brooklyn Rider, to me it sounds like it's very influenced by Josh's aesthetic, as was the thing I did with Brad Meldow. I'm collaborating upcoming with a wonderful young French jazz pianist who also is a very good classical player called Thomas Enco, E-N-H-C-O. And that project is going to be for piano, saxophone quartet, classical saxophone quartet, of all things, and drums. I believe Mr. Hollenbeck will join us for that. So that's going to be another thing entirely, you know. I mean, I'm writing choral music also. I wrote a big oratorio on the theme of the World War I poet Alan Seeger, the uncle of Pete Seeger. We're desperately trying to premiere that this November in New York, although we're not certain that it's going to happen, up at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine with Kent Treidle. That's sort of like a very kind of traditional choral oratorio, but with also jazz instruments added into that. So, I mean, it's kind of like I just bring my sensibility to bear on the context that I find myself in, and kind of enjoy having my collaborators rub off on me in various different ways.
And we should say the Joshua Redman Brooklyn Rider, that CD hopefully will be out before the end of the year. And then some people here listening might have gone to the concert at Princeton where they did parts of this, Aspects of Darkness and Light. And you questioned my use of the word thing, and I guess I have to use thing because we're in it and we're not away from it with perspective, because according with Joshua Redman, who has collaborated with a lot of people, but it might be seen as a jazz musician collaborating with others. And then you have Brooklyn Rider, a string quartet, which does a lot of new music, but also plays Beethoven and all the rest of that.
Yes.
And so we don't know, you know, well, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, you're a great example of all the lines are blurred and we get down to just Ellington's thing of it's either good music or it ain't, you know?
I guess so. I mean, I still feel like it's true that, but there are still cultures and, you know, I mean, classical culture is really different than jazz culture. And what do I mean by culture? I guess what it boils down to is, like, what did you spend hours in high school doing? Did you spend hours in high school sitting in a big band, or did you spend hours in high school, like, playing Beethoven in an orchestra? There is a sense of roots and grounding.
Yeah.
And I guess as I grow older, I kind of tend to look at those things as quite important, actually. You know, I mean, like, what you did when you were growing up, what you did when you were in high school, that kind of defines you and then grounds you also in a good way. And then you can kind of look out at other things. But there's a limit to it unless you go really deep. Like, you know, you can't just be a classical violinist who's played Mendelssohn concerto all your life and then be like, oh, I just want to improvise, you know.
Right.
That doesn't really work. There's a whole course of study. And similarly, if you've been playing in jazz clubs your whole life and you're like, oh, I just want to write for orchestra, there are some barriers to entry just in terms of, like, time and study and kind of, like, sitting for hours in X, Y, or Z context. It's not easy for people to go back and forth. It really is not.
I agree with you, but it's great to see that it's not only happening more often, it's actually becoming the norm rather than the crossover exception, you know.
That is true. Yeah.
Well, keep everything coming. All the stuff you're doing sounds really exciting as you're moving out. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been chatting, but chat with someone from the past who you never had a chance to chat with but could. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops into your head? I mean, if you think about it, you get swamped, but
I'll just go ahead with John Coltrane, although I had a cooler answer to that. But I'm going to go with Train, if only because I answered that in my college freshman literature humanities class.
Okay. All right.
And caused a stir at the time because I was the only person who selected an artist. It was weird. So I'm just going to go right back to Mr. Coltrane. Yeah, I'd be good to get with him.
Do you jam with him, or would it be intimidating?
Jamming isn't really something I undertake, but we could definitely do a project.
Okay, that'd be cool. He'd be up for that.
To where we have to spend some time and you know, coalesce our identities a bit.
The final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music, but when you have to do something that is non-musical, take yourself away, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but you need to step away, what do you do if you need to break?
Let's see. Well, gosh, a lot of things. I really like to read. I'm very interested in visual arts as well, and I go see a lot of visual art shows, particularly in Paris these days, since that's the place where I tend to have bits and pieces of free time. I'm definitely into the physical side of things, too. I like to go to the gym or do some yoga, and a big tennis fan.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, you are active. Well, Patrick Zimmerle, thanks for taking some time.
Thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
Composer, saxophonist Patrick Zimmerle. You can find out more about him at his website, patrickzimmerle.com. Recordings of his music are available on the Songlines and Nonesuch labels, to name two. You can check these out at his website as well. Though I should leave you with my guest playing saxophone, I don't think he'll mind the stage spotlight going over to the wonderful Joshua Redman here with the always engaging Brooklyn Rider String Quartet. This a teaser track from a CD coming out in a few months, a reprise of a track earlier on the disc. This the closing track called Between Dog and Wolf. Music by my guest today, Patrick Zimmerle. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.